Welcome back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are merging the streams between 23 years of doing sports radio and now our Baltimore Positive, what word podcast, now a complete website. All of it brought to you by our friends at Taharka, made in Baltimore, just like Baltimore Positive. A little caramel crunch here. We were talking pumpkin latte and pumpkin cheesecake and eggnog around the corner, serving up social change a scoop at a time. Delicious local, just like our friends over at El Guapo. I was wearing the shirt earlier this week. They're open now across from State Fair from the same management and ownership that have brought us the chicken and waffles and the shrimp and grits and all those delicious meals we had back before COVID when we used to do Baltimore Positive over there in Catonsville. Also, Fadley's, they're coming to Catonsville, but we've been doing it downtown with them at Lexington Market. You can order those crab cakes, ship them anywhere in the world, one click away. At Fadley's, world-famous crab cakes. You know how good they are. And last but never least, Moeller & Gary Realty, Don Moeller's son. Jeff had joined me at El Guapo the other night. I laid off the real estate market. We talked a little baseball, talked a little COVID, and we're trying to hold Don together here as we're into COVID. We are into the website being launched. We got an election right now. And this guest was on my original short list. I said when we started this thing 2 years ago, I remember getting together over in your little atrium over there at your house, Donna said, can you get Otterbaum Basu? And you're like, I know Otterbaum well. We'll get him on anytime. It's been almost 2 years, Moeller. What took us so long, huh?
I guess I was asleep at the switch, but it is a pleasure to welcome our good friend and chairman and CEO of the Sage Policy Group, Otterbaum Basu, to Baltimore Positive. Otterbaum, before I get you to jump in, I rarely do this, Nestor, but it's one of the great bios of all time. And you talk about a bio that captures someone that's important in the Baltimore region. It reads like this. Otterbaum is a study in contradictions. He's been called an economist with a personality, or alternatively, one with a sense of humor. He has twice been recognized as one of Maryland's 50 most influential people. He has also been named one of Baltimore region's 20 most powerful business leaders. He serves as chairman of the Maryland Economic Development Commission, teaches global strategy at Johns Hopkins University, serves as the chief economist function for a number of organizations around the country. He's read every one of Agatha Christie's novels, is an avid fan of James Bond, English football, Indian cricket, all Baltimore teams.
Dude, teach me cricket, by the way. I don't know the rules.
And lives with his wife and two daughters in Baltimore. Well, that sort of says it all. Otterbaum Basu, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you, Mr. County Executive. Thank you, Mr. Aparicio. It's a privilege to be with you today.
Well, I'll tell you this. I've never had a guy on my show in 30 years that could explain cricket to me that I knew. Because if I would have known he could explain cricket to me, I would have asked a lot. Because I've tried to understand cricket. The wicket, I don't get it. I don't understand it at all.
Well, it's a beautiful sport. It's about patience and resoluteness and intelligence and it's just a fabulous game, and it's captured much of the world's attention, just not a big deal in India. Sometimes the Indian Americans play it in Howard County parks for some reason, but otherwise we don't see a lot of it in Maryland.
Would you say patience, what was all those things I was thinking? Sounds like American politics, sort of like. Same game.
I was going to ask, is it folklore, or are there actually similarities, Otterbaum, to baseball, or is that just folklore?
Oh, no, there are similarities, right? Because baseball is about what? Not swinging at bad pitches. I mean, among other things, it's about defense. It's about taking advantage of opportunities when they present themselves. It's about running. It's about those kinds of things. And all of those things are present in both cricket and baseball. It's about hand-eye coordination, and it's beautiful. It's just that a cricket match can take 5 days. And I know a lot of people think that a baseball game that lasts 3 hours is too long. So there's that.
There's the patience. Well, let's jump right into it. We have so many topics, and I can't think of anyone better to address them. We have spent a lot of time, Otterbaum, over the past 6 months talking about what is about to happen to state and local governments all across the nation as a result of this fiscal crisis presenting itself as COVID. It seems to us that state and local governments don't have a lot of tools in their toolbox. So I wonder if you can address the premise of our question, that there is a crisis coming across the nation that people really aren't familiar with, and the fact that we're not sure there are a whole lot of tools in the toolbox to help them deal.
Well, that's exactly right. The issue is this. Unlike the federal government, state and local governments, whether municipalities or counties, have to balance their operating budget each and every year. They can't run deficits from one year to the next like the federal government, which just ran a $3 trillion, $3.1 trillion federal budget deficit for fiscal year 2020. State and local governments can't do that. They have to balance their budget. So if revenues are down and expenses are up, something has got to give. Either there's got to be more taxation, or there's going to be a cut of expenditures, including that which relates to workers. And those could be firefighters, police officers, whomever. But people who really provide for our shared quality of life in Central Maryland and throughout the country. And on top of that, coming into this crisis, we had underfunded pensions and many other issues facing state and local governments. So yes, I think the word crisis is appropriate.
Well, I mean, let's just start with basic things like picking up the trash and things like that. History here would be probably different than anywhere else. To see that this happened here, that we would be a country of this kind of wealth, to be hit with this, that I don't know that there's a playbook for this. There was a playbook for the plague. I don't know that there's a playbook for a plague on the economy.
No, there's no playbook here. I mean, what you need to do is really make good decisions about what's important to government, what needs to be a government-provided service, and what needs not be a government-provided service. In other words, the private sector can think about that. And of course, we tend to ask these questions most aggressively when there are fiscal shortfalls, and there are fiscal shortfalls everywhere. And you know, cities and states have their hands tied behind their back because the taxpayer at the same time does not want their taxes raised. And they'll live with some tax increases. We just saw that in Baltimore County very recently, but you can't raise taxes indefinitely. And Baltimore City, my goodness, highest property tax rate in the state. And so there's a great limit on what Baltimore City can do to raise revenues. At the end of the day, then you have to cut expenditures. And that's hard because that's going to affect somebody negatively, including city or county workers.
Arnabon, how do they resist? And we've had different guests. We've had journalists. We've had business leaders. We obviously have had elected leaders. How do governments resist? And I know you're doing some work with the city now, and I know you've done work in the past and continue to be very much in touch with Baltimore County, among others. How do local and state governments resist the temptation to do what I call the easy fix, which is the across-the-board cut through every department, which by all accounts, the experts tell us, is absolutely not the way to go?
Yeah, certainly not what an economist would do. So, you know, because some services are more valuable than others. I would argue, and you may disagree with me, Mr. County Executive, but I would argue that the most important thing right now in Central Maryland relates to public safety, right? So, you know, more than 300 homicides a year in Baltimore City, 50 last year in Baltimore County. And so you wouldn't want to cross the board cuts where you cut the police department like you cut every other department, because right now, we have a public safety, you could argue a crisis, certainly in the city and maybe in parts of the county. So you've got to make more strategic, surgical cuts to the budget. And I know it's challenging. And I know people want to spend more on education. They want it to, you know, put more into infrastructure and take on more debt service. But at the end of the day, as we say, you have to balance your budget every year. It's really challenging, especially when the taxpayer says, no must, no more. I'm not going to give any more. I can't. And by the way, I've been hurt by the pandemic too.
I've always thought of you as, the economist that I see the most, and I see your words. For economists and in the study of this over the course of time, finding municipalities that have done this well and then others that have done this poorly, and the study of this as you've done over the course of time, Baltimore struggles, modern American struggles with urban situations and where the money's going. I would think that the notion that people aren't going back to work in cities, this has to be the most frightening things. I live at the harbor. You talk about the issues we have here. It's why we started Baltimore Positive, two mayors ago. It'll be three mayors ago soon, right? And the issue was the city and what can save the city. I couldn't have thought 2 years ago, well, what happens after a plague comes to modern American cities when it comes to funding cities where people have left, the tax base has started to erode, and I guess I go to the Newark, New Jersey's, or the Detroit's, or the Camden, New Jersey, the places that have really fallen upon hard times, and Baltimore gets put in that category, let's say after Freddie Gray. where have these turnarounds come from? Because I know we spent some time here talking about Detroit and talking about cities that have had turnarounds. I just don't know how realistic that is after this whopper has happened across all specters of our government.
Oh, no, it's realistic. I mean, a city as large as New York City, which almost went bankrupt in the 60s and 70s, you know, look at New York City pre-crisis. I mean, New York City, like other cities, has had issues during the pandemic. But pre-crisis, you know, home prices are rising. Young families were moving to the city. You know, places like Brooklyn and the Bronx and the Queens became much more livable. Tax base grew. The city became safer. Oh, it's possible. If you can turn around New York City, you can turn around Baltimore. Here's the thing. When you look at Baltimore, you can see what's happened at Harbor Place. You can see we don't have that Barnes & Noble bookstore anymore. Dick's Last Resort. Restaurants have closed in Little Italy. The Joseph A. Banks store is closed. Dinosaur Barbecue is closed. Metropolitan Restaurant in Federal Hill is closed. Chauffeur's Furniture Store is closed in Federal Hill. My goodness.
You just mentioned my neighbor. Now you know why I'm doing Baltimore Positive. You've explained the reason, because I've watched all that happen.
Yeah, so the city is diminished. I mean, it's a vastly diminished city. But here's the thing. It still is a city of enormous promise. And we've been saying this for decades, right? But it's a city of enormous promise. Look at its location. I mean, it is, of course, the heart of its own metropolitan area, a metropolitan area of 2.8 million people, the Baltimore region, one of the most affluent, educated regions in the country. And by the way, among all the major northern metropolitan areas in America, New York, Boston, Seattle, Minneapolis, Detroit, no region of the country, the American North, has a lower unemployment rate than the Baltimore metropolitan area. It's because we're highly educated, a lot of white-collar professionals, a lot of people who can work remotely, large construction industry, so we've held up reasonably well during this downturn, and Baltimore City is at the heart of that. And at the same time, Baltimore City satisfies the definition, in large measure, of being a suburb of Washington, D.C., at least certain neighborhoods do. As early as 1990, Federal Hill satisfied the federal definition of being a Washington, D.C. suburb because so many Federal Hill residents commuted to the Washington metropolitan area for work. And some of the most affluent communities in the world are suburbs of Washington, D.C. So not only can Baltimore City be the epicenter of its own region, a magnificent region, highly educated, highly prosperous region, but also a suburb of Washington, D.C. And we've got the Port of Baltimore and I-95 and I-83 and all the rest of it. There's a lot of there. But you need good leadership, solid leadership, to replicate the successes of cities like Nashville and Denver and Austin and Philadelphia and Boston and New York and Portland and Seattle. Each of these cities have issues right now, of course, but Baltimore can follow in their footsteps, and we can have another renaissance.
Don, I want him to be on the team over with Jeff Mueller when I list my real estate. You know what I'm saying? Like,
you want that sales pitch. There's no doubt about it. When you signed up for this gig, and again, we are with the CEO of Sage Policy Group, Anirban Basu. When you sign up as an economic analyst and you have this terrific background, I don't know that pandemic or analyzing pandemic was in the job description. And when you try to make sense of this, and it now appears as we go to tape this interview, that unfortunately predictions of a fall surge appear to be happening. I see that just again today we hit 60,000 cases in the United States. That's not good. They're running out of hospital beds in Wisconsin. That's not good.
It's only because they're testing, Don. If they stop testing, we'd have right. No more cases.
So we're in bad shape. And I think, Arnabon, in addition to state and local government, which are key economic engines, we have large businesses and corporations, and we have small business. And we always hear that small business is the backbone of the United States economy. Are the challenges faced by corporate America and Main Street America the same? Are they different? And what do we need to be doing to make sure this thing doesn't truly crash a la 1929?
Look, it depends on the industry. So, I mean, yes. I mean, I would argue that small businesses have some disadvantages. You know, for instance, a typical small business, including my own, is not quite as important to our bank as a large business would be, right? So large businesses tend to have more solid banking relationships, insurance relationships, and those relationships can fall apart very quickly if a small business finds itself in financial difficulty, right? The line of credit is pulled, that kind of thing. That said, what have we seen here? Bankruptcy of Neiman Marcus, J.C. Penney, J. Crew, Brooks Brothers, the parent company of many other retailers that have gone bankrupt, Lane Bryant. And so large businesses and small businesses have suffered. Boeing has suffered. It'll be hard to find a bigger business than Boeing. Boeing has suffered during this crisis. And many small businesses have discovered that, hey, their workers can work remotely. We at Sage Policy Group have discovered that as well. All of our staff is working remotely and they're more productive than ever. So we've held up. We can deliver our service remotely. We're economists. So it depends. But I agree, small business is the backbone of America. One of the things that we have to do in Maryland to fulfill our potential is to be more attractive to small business owners, to those entrepreneurs, because one of the things I notice is that a lot of the people who start business in Maryland grow their businesses in Virginia or California or South Carolina or Florida. We want them to stay here, including when they're retired, by the way. We have a tendency to drive retirees out of our state like crazy as if they're a plague, but they're not a plague. We love people who are retired. They're the most easygoing amongst us, and they don't demand a lot from the government.
Well, that would be an issue that's hit my life. I've seen a lot of people just leave Maryland from a tax circumstance. What can be done about that on an economic level that can be offset that would make these people stay? Or you say, well, we got to incent them to stay. Well, that would mean fix their taxes in some way. That would mean less taxes for our government, right?
It might. But again, often people view this as a zero-sum game, right? You cut tax rates, you lose revenues. You raise tax rates, you raise revenues. That's not always true, right? Because you have to be able to grow your tax base. Baltimore City doesn't generate per capita tax revenues from its population the way that Baltimore County does, but Baltimore City has higher tax rates. So why is that? Because Baltimore City has not grown its tax base. Baltimore County has done a better job of that. Anne Arundel County has done a better job of that. Howard County has done a better job of that. And so the larger the tax base, the lower you can keep tax rates and still collect plenty of taxes. And it's more likely that you're going to actually add taxpayers. And that should be the goal for Baltimore City, which in the last year for which we have data lost 9,000 more people. So while other cities, Denver, Washington, Nashville, Austin, have been adding population by leaps and bounds, Baltimore City, which was 950,000 people in 1950, is now less than 600,000 people. That doesn't work from a tax-based perspective.
No, and I think that number is going to be even worse given the current census, which will then dictate a lot of policy over the next 10 years. Not only the fact that I think there would have been additional reduction in the number of residents in the city, but I think the current trying to count in a pandemic is also going to negatively impact the city. You alluded to another issue that a number of our guests have brought up, and that is the realization over the past 7 or 8 months that there are a number, particularly white-collar workers in our economy, who can actually work fairly effectively and efficiently at home. And as someone who's always looking forward, trying to identify trends, what is the impact of that, Anubhan, on major developers? And I'll think of a couple, one in Baltimore City, someone like Mark Weller and Weller Development, someone like Howard Hughes that's trying to do great things and doing great things in Columbia, Maryland. What's the impact of this new world order where we find out people, particularly white-collar workers, can work at home? What's that mean for the growth of the office industry in the Maryland and across the country?
Well, it obviously slows the growth of the office industry. It has to, right? When we discovered that 37% of people can do their jobs completely from home, and in many cases are more productive at home than they are on the job. Why? Because when they're on the job, what are they doing? They're contemplating coworkers. They're being dragged into impromptu meetings. They're hanging out the water cooler. They're filling out their NCAA brackets, so on and so forth. Not to say there aren't distractions at home, but you don't have that lengthy commute back and forth. You're not stuck on I-83 or I-695 for an hour. You're in a better mood. You know, you're woke, you're comfortable, so on and so forth, and you get to work. And so that can't be good for the office market. Now, that said, a lot of people like to go into the office. They won't admit it. But that's, we meet our coworkers, we make friends there, we share ideas there, we hold each other accountable there. So I don't think office work disappears, not at all. But if you ask me the question, is the office market or the new construction market for office space, has that been impacted negatively by this? Of course it has. And so too has the development of hotels and retail space and other forms of commercial space. If you ask me the question, is commercial real estate in crisis in Central Maryland? I would say yes, it's in crisis in Baltimore County, it's in crisis in Baltimore City. And part of that is because we've discovered that more people can do things remotely and shop remotely, and they're willing to do that. They buy cars remotely. They buy computers remotely. They buy appliances remotely. They buy all manner of things remotely. So what do you need stores for? And then many malls are going to go bankrupt or close in the next 5 years. You're going to see about a fourth of all the 1,200 malls in America close over the next 3 to 5 years, a fourth of them.
And does everything I see out my window in the sky from the ground up, is that going to be living space moving forward in every city? I mean, we talk about New York exiting and people leaving there and industry leaving there and just humans saying, I need more space because of the virus. I'm just concerned moving forward. This isn't a Baltimore. You mentioned Baltimore City or Baltimore. It's across the entire country that every piece of office space everywhere will no longer be desirable anywhere.
Right. We've seen apartment rents crumble in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Meanwhile, home prices have been surging in Westchester County, New York, and Fairfield County, Connecticut, the New York suburbs of Connecticut. And so what's happening here? The previous decade was the decade of the cities. That's when cities like Sarasota, Nashville, Atlanta, Orlando, Austin, Boston, Washington, D.C. really grew economically. Tax base and population. Baltimore City, for the most part, missed it. Oh, we had some millennials move in. You can see that in Locust Point, Federal Hill, Fells Point, so on and so forth. But not enough to offset overall population decline. The next decade will be the decade of the suburbs. And it's because mortgage rates are so low. So some people are saying, let me take advantage of this to buy, by buying a home. It's because the millennials are turning into the 30s now. Some of the millennials are already in their 30s. They're forming households, thinking about school districts. They want more space for that home office. They want a backyard for their kids. They want to be in a safer environment, whatever it happens to be. And then also in our Baltimore region, we have some further competition emerging for Baltimore City. What is that? Downtown Towson, downtown Columbia. These, let's call it urban light experiences. If Baltimore City couldn't add population in the previous decade, it's going to have even more difficulty this decade. So you're going to need great leadership in the city going forward to turn this thing around.
Well, you just alluded to interest rates. And that was one of the questions that I was thinking about as we were preparing for your, Nestor likes to call them intelligent conversations today. With record low interest rates, Arnaban, should governments, federal, state, and local, should they be borrowing a significant amount of money to invest in infrastructure because now's the time to do so, and that will have a significant economic return?
This is what I would say, Mr. County Executive. It is a great time for the federal government to borrow money and assist state and local governments in terms of taking care of their infrastructure needs. Might I remind you that the Highway Trust Fund goes insolvent next year? So the federal government has not been positioned to help state and local governments push the infrastructure ball down the field. And of course, we have lots of infrastructure deficits in Maryland and throughout the country, whether it's in the form of crumbling bridges or roads that are potholed or whatever it happens to be, just traffic congestion. And so the federal government is looking at extraordinarily low borrowing costs right now. The yield on a 10-year treasury today was 0.732%, right? That's less than inflation. So the federal government doesn't have to balance its budget every year. And it can borrow quite freely. Right now, what it should be doing is borrowing money and providing some support, some relief to state and local governments who have been affected by this crisis, and also help them with their capital budgets to invest more in infrastructure, including school construction.
Not the exact same concept, because I'm not talking about infrastructure, but we can't have you on without having you talk about the CARES Act, and it's hung up whether we should have more, whether it should be $2.6 trillion, $1.8 trillion. You pick a number. My question for you that, again, I think folks raised for Nestor and me, would another CARES Act make a difference? Is it important to keeping the economy moving, or is it all just political chatter?
No, we need one. Look, here's what's happening. So what happened? We shut down the economy in March and April. We lose 22 million jobs in March and April together. Unemployment goes from 3.5% pre-crisis to 14.7% in April. And we get the CARES Act, which is passed on March 27th. And that gives the economy some support during the summer months. And we're adding jobs. But by September, job growth had really softened. In June, we added 4.8 million jobs. By September, 661,000. The economy is slowing. The virus is still there. Colder temperatures are coming, and we're headed for another set of economic shutdowns. So this economy is in trouble. The first phase of recovery was pretty brisk. I would say V-shaped, incomplete recovery, but pretty brisk. But we're headed for, I think, a second economic downturn as the economy shuts down again, as the virus begins to creep more and more into our lives and causes more hospitals to be overwhelmed with patients. And so what do you need then? If you're going to have another round of job losses, you need more support from the federal government. So you bet $2 trillion will make an enormous difference for the American people until we can get to a vaccine.
He is Anirban Basu. He is with the Sage Policy Group. You know him around town and certainly have seen him speak. We haven't had him on the program yet, and I would have preferred to have you on for the bigger picture before the plague hit. But right. Now that we have a plague, we've gummed it up for you. We're going to make the equation even more difficult for you.
That's right. Well, the fact that I haven't been here is obviously Don's fault, and we've talked about that. I apologize on his behalf.
Had your number all along.
I own it fully. Hey, Anirban, the other thing that grabbed my attention in the past week to 10 days, and maybe you can give our listeners sort of a four dummies view of this, and that is both Moody's and Goldman Sachs have come out in the last 10 days, 2 weeks. They do some kind of an analysis, and they go public, and they say, we've looked at Trump's plan, and we've looked at Biden's plan, and from a Wall Street perspective, we think the economy is likely to do better under a Joe Biden presidency. What kind of factors are they looking at Wall Street when they make those kinds of projections?
So many factors, Don. So let's think about first trade policy, right? So global supply chains are buckling. Global trade is not what it once was. You know, after World War II, what did we do? We created organizations like the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the United Nations to try to bring the world together and become mutual trading partners. So now Japan is one of our leading trading partners, not our enemy. The same is the case with the Italians and the Germans. Germany is now the fourth largest economy in the world. Japan is third. So the world has changed, and a lot of that is because of trade and the positive impacts of trade, though trade often gets a bad name. Let's think about things like the environment. Let's think about things like immigration policy, right? Because if you don't have budgets that are large enough, if you don't have enough taxpayers, immigrants, you know, legal immigrants is what I'm talking about, they're the taxpayers of the future. I mean, they add to the tax base. And plus we have many unfilled construction, manufacturing, and other jobs in this economy, even during a pandemic. We can't find enough welders, machinists, carpenters, so on and so forth. And so in terms of economic growth, to the extent that Joe Biden deals with trade issues in a very constructive fashion, deals with immigration in a very constructive fashion, and also provides more relief to state and local governments. Because right now there's this narrative, we don't want to bail out New Jersey. We don't want to bail out Illinois. This is not about bailing out New Jersey and Illinois. We're from Maryland. We don't want to bail out New Jersey. We don't want them driving through our state even. But what do we want? You can see how much revenue those states have lost since February. You can see it. If you can backfill some of that, you don't lose many jobs for police officers, firefighters, teachers, garbage collectors, and other public workers. Because if those people lose their jobs, it makes the situation that much worse from a quality of living standpoint and from the perspective of economic recovery. So I think that's what the market is thinking about. And they might be also thinking about a situation in which Joe Biden is president, but the Senate remains Republican. And divided government often has been good for the stock market.
Is the corporate tax rate, as it was adjusted under Trump's tax cuts, is that too low in the United States of America?
Oh, this is a tough one. I would say it probably is. That corporations probably overall are not paying enough, given how profitable some companies have become. I mean, Amazon is a behemoth from a profitability perspective, but they don't pay a lot in corporate taxes. Nothing against Amazon. They have helped a lot of people during this crisis. They employ a lot of Americans. It's, you know, overall, I would say a force for good, though I'm sure many retailers would disagree. But they should pay their fair share of taxes. And so President Barack Obama, when he was running for re-election in 2012, suggested the corporate tax rate should be 28%. His Republican challenger, Mitt Romney, said, no, Mr. President, I think it should be 25%. And somewhere between 25% and 28%, I think from a moderate perspective, that's pretty much threading the needle.
So we're going to have an election on November the 3rd. By all accounts, Bob Wallace has certainly won an aggressive race as an independent. But by all accounts, latest poll numbers that we've seen, Brandon Scott's going to win. He's going to be the next mayor. I know you know Brandon. I know you've advised the city. Take us into the room. And Brandon says, all right, Anirban, now it's real. What are two or three things I need to do right now to make Nestor happy as a Baltimore City resident and get our economy moving. What are you telling?
Well, Nestor's a tough nut to crack, I gotta say. But what I would say is this. You have to have the agency's function. Your first role is as Baltimore City CEO. You're the CEO of Baltimore City government. So what you have to have, you've got to have excellent functioning in your agencies. See, a lot of mayors, they want that big shiny object, right? They want bookmobiles and they want, you know, this program or that program. But ultimately what you've got to do first, you've got to have the agency's function. Number one agency that has to function well, Baltimore City Police Department, right? Because that there, you have to regain that trust as a department to try to solve this issue of more than 300 homicides per year in Baltimore City. You've got to bring that crime rate down. Otherwise, you cannot attract enough private investment. You cannot attract enough residents to grow that tax base. But the same is true for the health department and public works department. You know, right now we have this issue with the Department of Public Works and them privatizing the billing of water, because for years the city has messed that up. They can't even bill for water. How are you going to fight crime? How are you going to educate kids? So, a lot there, but you got the agencies to function first. I think that's number one. And beyond that, then you can start looking for the shiny objects, the programs that can really help this part of the population or that part of the population.
Well, I know you've made Nestor's head explode with that last answer, because that not only were you in the same hymnal, not only were you in the same chapter, you were on the same page. So,
it's been a long time since we've talked about that, though, Don, right? Hasn't it? I mean, like, literally, like, it's been 6 months since these kinds of issues, going back to the other election, where we're talking about the city, because it feels like the country's problems are so, you know, and the election, and I'm still holding my ballot here, Honor Bond. I'm encouraging everyone to make sure they vote, especially if they're in Pennsylvania. But yes, it does. It feels like the city's problems have been a little bit muddied through us watching Trump run around every night for the last 3 or 4 months.
But you've been consistent, Nestor, as we wrap it up here today, and we certainly will have Arnabon back because we need his insights regularly on Baltimore Positive. You have been consistent from day one on Baltimore Positive when we started 2 years ago with the idea that I just need someone, and this is what I hear Arnabon saying, I need someone to make the city work. And there's no better example than recently when they can't get the daggone trash picked up. And I know, you know, folks all over the city who are friends of mine just saying to me, I've given up, I'm putting my trash in bags, and I'm going to the dump because we can't pick the trash up. So when Arnabon talks about making the agencies work, I know he's singing your tune, Nestor.
Well, I appreciate it. Honorable, we got to let you go. And I tell you what, I do hope you come back again soon. I'm sorry we're not meeting under better conditions over coffee. It's some great civic event and all getting together, which is what we like to do around here. But hopefully soon we'll get a fist bump from you and be 6 feet away, maybe over a crab cake somewhere. All right.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you both. Thanks to your audience as well.
Bring that cricket handbook. I'm still going to need to learn all that. All right. Appreciate it. Arnabon Basu from the Sage Policy Group here. It's been a long time coming, but I'm glad he came on and made us a little smarter. All the intelligent conversations we're doing are now deposited in the repository at BaltimorePositive.com. You can find them there. Our sports work, Luke's out in Owings Mills, getting you ready for Ravens activity, and all of Don's work and my work up at BaltimorePositive.com. We are WNST.net, AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.